The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Later today, the UK's Parliament looks set to approve a bill empowering the Prime Minister, Theresa May, to start Brexit negotiations. It means the formal process of Brexit will be triggered next month, as expected, with the UK leaving the European Union 2 years later. Those 2 years will involve EU and UK officials sitting at a negotiating table trying to hammer out a deal about the terms of Britain's departure. And one of the people at the table will be Guy Verhofstadt, the former Belgian Prime Minister who is now the chief Brexit negotiator for the European Parliament. He's also just published a book in which he spells out his vision of how the EU should reform in the face of multiple threats, including, of course, Brexit. The book's called Europe's Last Chance. So I asked him, last chance before what?
Before, a collapse, a disintegration, what is always possible. If we look to the pressure on the European Union for the moment, coming from outside and inside, outside Trump, who is bidding on a disintegration of the Union, and also Vladimir Putin, who wants to divide the European Union, then there is also the threat of jihadism. And then internally, we have an enormous pressure by nationalist, populist, the whole question of Brexit. So it's an existential moment for the European Union. That's the reason why I have written this book as a wake-up call, saying, yeah, it's now the time to do a reform. Otherwise, it could disappear.
Hello and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. This is Richard Palmer, contributing editor for the Trumpet magazine, standing in for your regular host, Stephen Flurry. Now, last time I was on this show, we talked about how Donald Trump represents a crisis for Europe, about how he wants the European Union to break up, how he represents a major threat to Germany's economy, and we spoke a bit about how Europe to react to that. And so today we bring this program asking, is this Europe's last chance? We just heard from Guy Verhofstadt, the former Belgian Prime Minister, a very influential figure within Europe's Houses of Parliament, the European Parliament, saying there, well, this is an existential moment for Europe. People are asking, is the European Union going to survive? Can it hold together? And like he said, it is Europe's last chance. And many people like him think that that is true. But as we talk about this, and this subject of just the crisis that's building for Europe, there's something very important to keep in mind. Jean Monnet, one of the founding fathers of the European Union, he said, Europe will be forged in crisis and will be the sum of the solutions adopted for those crises. Crisis was, to him, the mechanism through which the European Union would be built. And we've talked about this and that quote in context of the euro crisis, in context of the Ukraine crisis, in context of the Middle East crisis. And it applies to the Donald Trump crisis too. This is another crisis that is pushing Europe to unite. Wolfgang Schäuble, he's the German finance minister, he said something similar in 2011. He said, crisis represents an opportunity. And that's what Donald Trump represents for Europe, for certain people within Europe, for certain people within Germany, those who want a united Europe, people like Guy Verhofstadt that wants a Europe to basically be a super state, people who want a powerful Germany. Crisis represents an opportunity. And Wolfgang Schäuble went on to say, I'm not saying that I enjoy being in a crisis, but I'm not worried. Europe has always moved forwards in times of crisis. Sometimes you need a little pressure for certain decisions to be taken. And that is what is happening to Europe right now. That, as you see more and more as we get into the material I'm going to cover today, is how Europe is reacting to Donald Trump. And we'll hear once again on this from Guy Verhofstadt. He's talking to the Business Daily program, actually, I believe, aired today on the BBC World Service.
It's a body blow, though, to the EU, isn't it, at Brexit? I mean, what sort of EU do you think there will be in 10, 20, 30 years' time, if there is an EU at all?
No, there will be, in my opinion, an EU. It will be smaller than 28. That's obvious because Britain is going out. And it will be a more united around a governance of the single currency with the European Defence Union, because it will be necessary to organize this, as also from the other side of the Atlantic Ocean, they are more critical towards Europe. So I think it's an enormous opportunity, Trump and at the same time Brexit, to get our act together and to put in place what the founding fathers had already in mind. That was a political union, a defense union, an economic union, a fiscal union. That was their idea in the 50s. I think that this idea of the founding fathers is returning now, is now again on the table as the only possible answers to the new world order that is shaping for the moment.
So these crises facing Europe, Brexit, the election of Donald Trump, as he said, this Donald Trump crisis, the election of Donald Trump, it represents an enormous opportunity for Europe. Europe, he said, is being pushed towards this superstate as the only possible solution to these crises that it's facing, just like Europe's founding fathers wanted. Now, Jean Monnet, that we quoted at the start, saying Europe will be forged in crisis, he was one of those founding fathers. He saw that they were only going to make that vision happen through crises, forcing Europe to get their to get together, to overcome the different national divisions. And Europe is progressing now just along the same lines that they envisioned, and those same things that they wanted, that they planned for in the 50s, the 60s. As Guy Verhofstadt said, they're emerging now as the only solution to all of the crises that are facing Europe today. So we'll review some material just from all across different people, news outlets across Europe, talking about how this crisis is a real opportunity for Europe and for Germany, and for ways that people are using it as an opportunity and using the pressure that Donald Trump is putting on Europe as Guy Verhofstadt said, an enormous opportunity. Judy Dempsey had a piece in Carnegie Europe towards the end of last week on this, and it was titled The Spectre of Pope of Post-Atlanticist Europe. That's a bit of a mouthful. But in that, she makes some great points. And she writes, all European Union leaders face a choice. They either allow the United States and Russia to divide the bloc and even destabilize it, or they realize that they have to complete a project begun 60 years ago in Rome. So they either fall apart or they have to go all the way now towards this superstate, this European Union. And she writes, don't EU leaders now finally understand that Europe faces instability, which in itself is so dangerous to even contemplate if they do not rise to the challenges that Trump and Putin are throwing at Europe? And then she writes, political and economic integration must now be pursued, and quickly. Germany, France, and the other Eurozone countries have a responsibility to push ahead. Whether or not all EU members support more integration or a two-speed Europe, integration should be made a priority. So in all of this, she's saying, well, Europe needs to unite quickly. Europe faces these huge challenges now after the election of Donald Trump, with America stepping back from the world, stepping back from Europe. These challenges could create a lot of instability. The only way the EU can cope is to unite. But notice what she says at the end there. Whether or not all EU members support more integration or a two-speed Europe, integration should be made a priority. So what she's saying there is that, well, some EU nations may not be on board with this quick push towards political and economic integration. They may not want to, and there are some that don't. Not necessarily a lot, but some that don't want to go towards further integration. So what she's saying is, well, we need to do this. We need to do this quickly. So those other nations that don't want to integrate, that don't want to be part of a European superstate, they can't be allowed to hold the rest back. So that's what she's talking about when she talks about a two-speed Europe. One group that moves very fast towards a superstate, while the rest stay behind or move more slowly in that direction. And actually, Europe is already moving forward on this. They had a meeting in Malta on Friday, and this was one of the key changes to emerge from that meeting. So Reuters, they wrote, after a summit in Malta in which all national leaders discussed plans for a formal declaration in March on the future of the bloc following Britain's departure, Merkel and others offered endorsements of a so-called multi-speed Europe. So again, where you get a core of nations move towards being a superstate while there's another set that hang back. A multi-speed Europe, which some governments fear could damage EU unity in the wake of Brexit. Though they disagree on the details, Paris, Berlin, and many of the 17 other states which use the euro currency are keen to bind the eurozone closer together after years of crises in which investors doubted the currency's survival. And there's how one crisis is already pushing Europe to unite, the euro crisis, putting a lot of pressure on the eurozone to draw closer together. Going back to this Reuters piece, it says the last few years, Merkel told reporters, showed that there will be an EU with different speeds and that not everyone will take part in the same level of integration. So this idea of a multi-speed Europe, it has been around for a long time, but it's not necessarily been endorsed at this high level coming from EU leaders the way that it has been over the weekend. And they note here one area in which governments are divided over the degree of integration is defence. With departure of longtime sceptic Britain, France and Germany are keen to develop closer EU ties. And then this article talks about how on March 25th, all the leaders of Europe, minus British Prime Minister Theresa May, she's not coming. They're going to meet in Rome, where they'll be celebrating the 60th anniversary of the founding of the Treaty of Rome. And they want to produce some kind of document that charts Europe's path forwards, how they're going to respond to these crises. And the French president, François Hollande, he said that he thought that this statement that's going to come out in Rome next month could mention several speeds as a possible way forward. And then also the Benelux countries, Belgium, Luxembourg, the Netherlands, and they put together a proposal, and they wrote that different paths of integration and enhanced cooperation could provide for effective responses to challenges that affect member states in different ways. So Europe, faced with these crises, faced with Brexit, faced with Donald Trump, faced with all the pressures that brings, they're looking for practical ways to move forwards. And one of the ones that's coming to the fore now is this multi-speed Europe, to have a core group of EU nations that move ahead much more quickly with integration. And for those of you that have been listening to us for any length of time, you know this is something that we've been forecasting for years. The Bible tells us to expect an EU made up of 10 nations or 10 groups of nations. Here's how Herbert W. Armstrong back in, I believe this is from the 80s, described what this coming European power is going to look like.
10 nations, the Bible prophecy says, are going to unite in Europe, and they will be probably more powerful than either the Soviet Union or the United States. When all the nations of Europe get together, there will be 10 of them.
So we know there's going to be 10 nations. Right now, there's a lot more than 10 nations within the European Union. So we've been saying for years that there would be some process to shrink things down, where either nations leave the European Union or the Eurozone, or they form a core group, just like they've been talking about over the last weekend, that pushes much more quickly towards integration. And here's a quote from a Key of David, a soundbite from or a couple of clips from a Key of David program, where Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Flurry explained just exactly what the Bible says to expect from this group.
It's comprised of those 10 horns or 10 kings will make up this head, the seventh head. And when you see the financial meltdown in Europe today, and in America and Britain, and in really the whole Western world especially, it is going to have everything to do with shaping and making the final combination of nations over there very, very quickly. It is this crisis that's going to shape and mold what is known as the Holy Roman Empire. And that's what these 10 nations are all about. In other words, this financial meltdown is virtually forcing that 10-nation union to form. They've been talking about it for years, but they've got far more than 10 nations unified now, but it's about to fall apart. What does it mean? Does it mean it's all going to fall apart? No, it does not. There's going to be a core group of nations that are going to remain a church-state union that is going to shock and shake this world as it has never been shaken before. Notice what another little excerpt here. All debts of Greece, Cyprus, Italy, Spain, Portugal, and Ireland will be fused immediately with German debt. See, Germany is the real power here, and a single treasury and so on. This is the sort of game changer that may now be required to save this union. This is a game changer. Yes, it is. It's a world changer. It's much more than just a game changer. It's going to change the world. And it's going to have, Europe is going to have more power and not less, only it's going to be considerably smaller. You watch and see if that doesn't happen, because your Bible says it has to. There's going to be 10 kings there, not 27. And as there are 27 nations today in that European Union.
So that's a very clear and direct prophecy, and one that we're watching right now unfolding and being fulfilled. And there Mr. Fleury was talking about how just the pressure from the euro crisis, from that economic crisis, is really forcing this union. And that really has been just one of the major pressures on Europe over the last few years. And now we see the addition of these other pressures from Brexit, from Donald Trump. And like I said, there are some that see this as an opportunity to push for that union that they've wanted. So this is one area, like we said, we see that prophecy being fulfilled. But going back to this Judy Dempsey piece that we started with from Carnegie Europe, she also points out something we heard from that Reuters article as well, where much has already been written about the need for a credible EU defence and security policy. Europe's weak external borders, the terrorist threat, and the weakening of America's security commitments to Europe are surely enough reasons for European leaders to take their defence seriously. And even if Trump does commit himself to continuing America's security umbrella over Europe, that itself is not enough to deal with the internal and external threats the EU faces. And this is something we'll see as we read a few of these different articles. This is forcing now Europe to look at having its own army, its own military. She then goes on to say that Europe needs to do more to set up its trade deals with the rest of the world, now that it can't rely so much on trade with America. And it's really forcing Europe, but also creating an opportunity for Europe to really take the lead in the world's financial system, or try and take the lead and form just an alternative financial power block to the United States. But this one excerpt from Carnegie Europe, it's far from the only piece saying this, where we also heard Guy Verhofstadt on this subject as well. Here's an article from the EU Observer that was written in Malta while the EU leaders were at that meeting on Friday in Malta, and it's called EU Leaders Forced to Unite in New Trump Reality. Forced to Unite, and they write here, EU leaders pledged the need for unity and for Europe to stand up on its own two feet during their meeting at Valletta on Friday during a discussion on how to handle US President Donald Trump, whom EU Council Chief Donald Tusk described earlier as a threat to the EU. Leaders emphasized the importance of the transatlantic alliance, saying they would work together with Trump on common interests, but move towards more independent European action on issues where the EU and US administrations disagree. But note what they note here just a little further down in that article. But Merkel said that this is an opportunity. Again, we see that word. It's an opportunity for Europe to redefine itself and become more self-reliant. So yes, this is a crisis for Europe. Yes, there are a lot of pressures on Europe because of all these decisions Donald Trump is making. But it is an opportunity as well for those that want Europe to play a greater role in the world and for those that want Europe to unite. The former Finnish Prime Minister here had an article in the Financial Times over the weekend. I won't quote too much from it because Mr. Fleury quoted from that a bit on his program on Monday. But again, it makes the same point, and it was titled, "It's Europe's turn to fill the global power vacuum." And that's the way that some in Europe see this. They see Donald Trump reducing, there certainly are some or a large amount that see Donald Trump reducing America's role in the world, and they are scared, they are worried. They see how this is destabilizing. But there are some that say, well, the US is stepping back. This is a chance for us to step up, for Europe to step up and replace them. And this is what the former Finnish Prime Minister sees. He writes, the US and Soviet Union dominated world politics for the better part of 40 years. With the Soviet collapse, the US filled the power vacuum and became the undisputed superpower of the world. And then just a little bit later, the big question in 2017 is, who will begin to fill the power vacuum left by the US? Well, he goes on to talk about the need for Europe to take on global leadership. He says the US is fast losing credibility as the leader of the free world, and the EU alone can take on that mantle. So the EU wants to be, he wants the EU now to be the leader of the free world. He also writes that the EU must take a lead in foreign and security policy. Just like we heard in that Reuters piece and in that Carnegie Europe piece. And finally, he writes, the EU must take a stronger role in world trade. So again, he's saying, well, the US is not promoting free trade, so the EU should step up, snap up trade deals everywhere, become a core part of the of an alternative global trading system. And he singles out Mexico as a country the EU must pry away from the American orbit. And then he concludes, the US is handing over the key to world politics. So there are some in Europe that are saying, well, look, the US is handing over the key to world politics. This is a great opportunity for us to grab that key. You see China scrambling to put themselves in that position. You see Russia scrambling to put themselves in that position. And then some in Europe also feel like this is their chance to take on that position. He said, we should leave the door ajar for its return. But meanwhile, I hope the EU will seize the moment, grab the key, and start taking a more prominent role on the world stage. So the Trump crisis is an opportunity for those that want a strong Europe. But it's also an opportunity for Germany, and it's one that they're taking. German Foreign Policy had an article over the weekend. I forgot to note down the title. But they write that some members of the German establishment are expecting the EU's ascent parallel to the United States' descent on the world stage. So there are some there watching America fall, and they believe that as quickly as America falls, the EU is going to rise. They talked about a meeting of the Konrad Adenauer Foundation, a foundation associated with the Christian Democratic Union, and in that the Lucia Puttrick, the Hessian Minister for Federal and European Affairs, he said that Europe will have to become more independent and more responsible, and we will need to take on a completely new role. He said, I want a jolt through Europe. So they see, well, Europe needs to have a new role, and this is going to send a jolt through Europe. It's an opportunity. And you can actually see Angela Merkel taking advantage of a bit of an opportunity here now. I think she's more trying to take advantage of it in terms of positioning for re-election and that election coming up. But German Foreign Policy and then also the Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung made an interesting point. And that is the Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung wrote that Ms. Merkel leaves nothing heard or read from the new administration unanswered. So everything that Donald Trump does or says that is controversial, Angela Merkel has a response to. And that's deliberate. She's not just letting anything slide by. And then more than that, both these articles point out that the Chancellor is not even confined to making the differences publicly known by her government spokesman, Stefan Siebert. So usually if you have a difference, what has happened generally in the past, if there's a difference between the US and Germany, well, Ms. Merkel doesn't necessarily want to make a big deal about it. And so she'll have her spokesman read out a statement. And that way, you know, you don't have this video footage and these headline pictures of the German Chancellor criticizing the US president. Instead, you have a spokesman reading a statement. It's less confrontational. But as this article points out, she does and she says it herself. And for example, I had a look at just how Germany dealt with the NSA spying scandal a few years ago, where the US was caught tapping Angela Merkel's phone, and it caused a lot of outrage in Germany. But you didn't get many speeches from Angela Merkel. She barely touched the subject. It came up in questions and things. And I think, for example, she said that spying on friends is misguided. But in general, she just did everything through her spokesman. And that's what you do if you want to downplay the criticism. Okay, you know, there needed to be a response, but rather than Ms. Merkel personally going out and criticizing America, you know, she does it a bit at arm's length, do it through the spokesman. It's not as dramatic. But in this case, Ms. Merkel has been responding personally to everything Mr. Trump has been doing and saying, playing up the differences between them. It is a I mean, she modestly kind of denied being leader of the free world when someone asked her about it back in December. But this is, she has a deliberate policy here of confronting Mr. Trump to kind of to show herself as one of the foremost defenders of these kind of liberal values. And I think probably for her, her main consideration is the election and trying to show herself as just being the only international heavyweight that can stand up to someone who is very unpopular within Germany. I think you have to remember that Mr. Obama, when he left office in Germany, had an approval rating of about 80 or 90% among Germans and the French as well. So he was hugely popular over there. Donald Trump, much less so. And so I think she's kind of trying to play herself up as a leading opponent of Donald Trump for her, for the home field. But it's something that also Germany benefits from as well. Miss Merkel, she's been very strongly praised in the US media for this. You know, so many accolades, like we've quoted on this program, talking about Germany being a new leader of the free world. And as German foreign policy wrote that, well, they wrote the concerted effort with the liberal US opposition offers Berlin new possibilities for expanding influence. So it's helping boost Angela Merkel, but it's helping to boost Germany's prestige, its influence, its image on the world scene, backed by many in America and the American media. And so they're stepping up, and it's an opportunity for to increase German power and clout as well. Now, there's one more article I'd like to share with you in this segment, and this is also from Carnegie Europe, and it's called Germany, the Not-So-Timid Leader. And that's not-so in brackets. I guess that doesn't really work so well reading it out on the air. But this was just a really insightful article. But it says, which European country is one of four allies to lead a battalion of NATO-enhanced forward presence in the Baltic countries and Poland, is the biggest European contributor to NATO's deterrent measures in Eastern Europe, and has soldiers deployed in 12 operations from Mali to Iraq? It's Germany. The country, usually portrayed as a civilian and economic power par excellence, but rather allergic to military issues. Almost silently, Germany has changed its defense policy over the last 4 years. In 2013, the incoming government, led for a third term by Chancellor Angela Merkel, defined the leitmotif of a new security policy. Now, at the end of the legislative period, it's time to take stock. And it is a fascinating stock-taking. The article goes on to talk about the major shift that came at the 2014 Munich Security Conference, where top German leaders announced that Germany was going to play a bigger role and a bigger military role. And we've covered that extensively a few times at the Trumpet. It was a major shift. But then the article goes on to state, well, in this context, Russia's annexation of Crimea in 2014 and the Ukraine crisis not only jolted the rule-based European security order, unequivocally supported by Berlin, it pushed Germany to put its rhetoric into action. So that Munich Security Conference and then that force of the Crimea crisis after that forced Germany to take some major action. And again, this is something that we've commented on. We'll listen to a quick clip. Well, it's a more lengthy clip, actually, from A Key of David, from Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury again on these developments, where he was just quoting an article that really clearly outlines what has happened and then adds some of his own thoughts, just describing what happened back there at the beginning of 2014 and that major shift in German thinking and action on its military.
George Friedman of Stratford talked about this dramatic change in the military structure of Germany in just the last week. What does it mean to you? He talked about a brazen foreign policy change, a radical position. Again, it may not all have been because of what Russia did in the Ukraine, but it certainly made them realize the urgency of beefing up their military and restructuring it in a massive way. Notice what George Friedman wrote in the Stratford Geopolitical Weekly, February the 4th. He and Mark Lanthimum. Notice what he said. Since the end of World War II, Germany has pursued a relatively tame foreign policy, but over the past week, Berlin appeared to have acknowledged the need for a fairly dramatic change. German leaders, including the chancellor, the president, and foreign minister, and the defense minister, have called for a new framework that contravenes the restraint Germany has practiced for so long. They want Germany to assume a greater international role by becoming more involved outside its borders, politically and militarily. It has to adjust to the U.S. policy of global disengagement, which is also prophesied. What does he mean, U.S. policy of global disengagement? Well, everybody around the world knows what it means, that there's a huge vacuum left out there in the world, and the Germans and the Russians and others are filling that vacuum. And it's becoming a far more dangerous world than ever before. He goes on to say, and it must manage a complex, necessary, and dangerous relationship with Russia. See, all of this is prophesied in your Bible, and we've been talking about it for many years. One more comment here. Friedman wrote, for Germany, it is a radical position. Given the experience in World War II, it has refrained from asserting a strong foreign policy and from promoting its national interest, lest it revive fears of German aggression and German nationalism. So if you look closely at what Germany has done in the past, look, it is just a fact and the truth that they started World War I and World War II and have started other wars. Now this is Bible prophecy that's going to reach out and touch the lives of every single one of us in a way that you can't even imagine. Do we know what's going on in Europe? Do we understand what's happening? There are powerful lessons that we need to learn from history, and we're not learning. We don't seem to have an interest in history today. Almost, it's non-existent in the universities. Why? Well, it's because of misguided people, frankly. Notice what Stratford wrote. Either something new must be introduced into the European experiment, we'll go back to that, or it might come undone. Berlin believes that holding the European Union together requires adding another dimension that it heretofore has withheld in its dealing with the bloc, military and political relations. Oh, they have to really unify and bring it all together. They have to have a strong military. Well, that's the way they thought before World War I and before World War II. Where is this leading? I'll tell you, there is good news because every single bit of this is tied directly to the coming of the Messiah. Only He can solve this problem.
So there you have a fairly comprehensive outline of what was going on back at the beginning of January 2014. Some of those shifts that were going on in German thinking, and Germany was looking at getting more involved in the world. And you know, things may not have happened quite as quickly as some in Germany may have wanted. But as this article does, look at where Germany is now, 3 years on from that radical shift. And this article says, what followed was a remarkable political commitment by Germany, such as the Minsk Accords and Normandy format aimed at stopping the fighting in Ukraine. Berlin then substantially shaped the political and military course of NATO's return to the territorial defense, which the alliance decided at its 2014 Wales summit. In fact, Germany re-established itself as a discrete backbone of NATO. For the Bundeswehr, this required substantial changes. Over the last decade, it had concentrated on crisis management, mainly in Afghanistan. Suddenly, the German armed forces had to relearn territorial defense, which required considerable modifications of and investment in personnel, doctrines, and equipment. This was even more difficult, given that over time, budget and capability cuts, combined with bad management, had left the Bundeswehr in bad shape. Berlin is now reversing those downward trends. The number of main battle tanks and armored personnel carriers will increase. Improved maintenance will also improve readiness. After several years of decline, Germany's defense budget will rise in 2017 for the second year in a row to reach 36.6 billion euros. And it talks a bit more about that spending level. And then Then this author, Claudia Major, she goes on to write, change is most visible in Germany's military missions. Berlin now participates in operations more often, in different forms and more offensively, particularly in its strong participation in NATO's defense and deterrent activities. A new approach was the introduction of the Enable and Enhance initiative, in which Germany trains and equips regional actors, including in Iraq and Mali, to help build capacity to provide their own security. Another noticeable development was Germany's quick decision to participate in the anti-IS coalition following the November 2015 Paris attacks, which, like the Iraq mission, stretched the legal framework for Bundeswehr deployments because the missions do not operate in collective security systems such as the UN, but as part of an ad hoc coalition. Within a short time frame, Berlin crossed traditional red lines, thereby moving the point of reference for military deployment. So Germany crossed some significant red lines in those, and I wrote about that at the time for The Trumpet, where they reinterpreted their constitution to say that they could deploy overseas. Previously, they could deploy overseas only within collective security arrangements. Now, all they need to do is have allies and to be defending allies overseas, which, you know, just about every nation that ever fights has allies, removing pretty much any of the remaining restrictions on the German military's deployments overseas. As it said, crossing those red lines, which then makes it so much easier to have more and more deployments in the future. So some huge changes going on within Germany. But then in the conclusion, this article returns to our theme that we've been talking about. You know, Europe being forged in crisis, the Donald Trump crisis, presenting an opportunity for some in Europe to get what they've been wanting for a long time. And so Claudia Major, she writes, overall, Germany has become most active when partners or events create the necessary pressure, such as the Ukraine crisis, which forced Berlin to take over diplomatic and military leadership. In other cases, like the fight against the Islamic State, Germany only became active when the refugee crisis turned into a domestic issue or when it was critical for an important partner. So, again, it's this Germany has only really been acting when pressure has forced it to act. And then this article finishes by noticing, yet the rapidly changing security environment, combined with the West's current internal problems from Trump to Turkey to populism, will not allow Germany to take a break. The challenge for the new government is not only to continue assuming greater responsibility for European security, but to increase it and make it sustainable. So Donald Trump, yes, it is a crisis for Europe. It's putting a lot of pressure on Europe. But his policies, his election, they're also an opportunity. And people are starting to see this. His election, as we've said right since November, is hastening some major changes within Europe. We'll take a quick break. And when we get back, we'll talk about some articles we have on our website, thetrumpet.com, as well as take a bit of a sneak preview to one or two stories that will be up there soon. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is The Trumpet Daily. Herbert W. Armstrong long forecast the arrival of a military superpower in Europe. In a world where European nations can't rely on the United States, one in which they fear Russia and face the constant threat of radical terror, their only hope of survival is to band together. This is what we see happening. And what we see happening was prophesied in your Bible. Request Germany and the Holy Roman Empire to learn about the history of Germany and the Holy Roman Empire and to understand where the events in Europe today are leading. 3,000 years ago, the prophet Daniel explained that at the time of the end, radical Islam would push against Europe. That time is now. We are witnessing the first manifestations of this Islamist push against Europe, and it's leading to a spectacular clash between these two prophesied kings, the King of the North and the King of the South. What does the Bible say about the identity of these two kings? What about the end time? Will everyone be affected by these events? Request our two booklets, The King of the South and Germany and the Holy Roman Empire. To learn more, please visit thetrumpet.com. The Trumpet Daily Radio Show airs every morning at 7 a.m. Central Time on KPCG 101.3 FM in Edmond, Oklahoma.
Welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. This is Trumpet Contributing Editor Richard Palmer standing in for your regular host, Stephen Flurry. Now, on yesterday's show, Mr. Flurry read some startling statistics about the British Navy. Well, today we have an article that's just gone up on our website in the last hour or two with some startling statistics from the American Navy. The article is titled, More Than Half of U.S. Navy Aircraft Grounded. And it's based on a report from Defense News that's based on unnamed Navy sources. And it states there that the Defense News says that that half of United States aircraft can't fly, quote, because there isn't enough money to fix them. Now, that means that that 1,700 combat planes, support aircraft that are not available to fly. And then for the F-18 Hornet and Super Hornet, the situation is even worse. Nearly two-thirds are out of service. And so they wrote that the F-18s are the tip of the spear, embodying the most fierce striking power of the aircraft carrier strike group. That was from Defense News. But nearly two-thirds of those planes out of service. Now, that's something that's very important because America's Navy really is built around this naval air arm. It's built around the air power. You know, since the Battle of Midway during World War II, the U.S. Navy has really relied on warplanes as being that decisive element in naval fighting. And it was the aircraft that really carried the day at that Battle of Midway. And so the entire U.S. Navy is really built around carrier strike groups, where you have one of those colossal nuclear-powered aircraft carriers, and then that's surrounded by a whole bunch of escort ships that are basically there to keep the aircraft carrier safe so that the planes can take off and land. There'll be submarines, anti-submarine ships, air defense destroyers, that kind of thing, all surrounding the aircraft carrier. And so if you've got problems with the aircraft, with things like two-thirds of the aircraft being out of service, this is something that's major for the Navy. But it's also affecting pilots. Defense News, they wrote, with training and flying hour fund cuts, the Navy's air crews are struggling to maintain even minimum flying requirements. They said retention is becoming a problem too. In 2013, 17% of flying officers declined department head tours after being selected. The percentage grew to 29% in 2016. So a lot of people quitting the Navy, pilots quitting because of low morale, because they're not able to practice. And then the ships are suffering as well. So the Navy keeps having to postpone repairs and overhauls of ships in the fleet. And the Defense News, they quoted a senior naval official saying that overhauls to another 14 ships are going to be delayed or deferred in 2018. There's one submarine, the Boise, or the Bose, I don't know how on earth that's pronounced, but it's lost its diving certificate and is unable, they can't use it because it's so behind on repairs. And they say that if more money doesn't become available, then by the end of this year, 2017, there'll be five more submarines in that condition. And then even just the onshore facilities that the Navy uses to repair and maintain its fleet, well, 15% of those are in need of repair, replacement, or demolition. So some major problems within the U.S. Navy there. And that, like I said, if half of the Navy's planes can't fly, two-thirds of its actual attack aircraft cannot fly, those are some major problems. And that's something, this kind of thing is something that we've talked about before on this show. But what are we seeing at the same time? You know, we're seeing America's military struggle, and yet we're seeing China, as we've talked about on this show, Russia, other nations rising abroad. Here's just a brief clip from what Mr. Flurry had to say on this in a Key of David program in 2015.
This world, this violent world, is becoming one big military arsenal of nuclear weapons and other weapons of mass destruction, and all kinds of conventional warfare armaments. But as we look at these powers of the world, they keep expanding their military as the United States and Britain shrink theirs. Does that really make sense to you? What is happening in this world, and what is happening to America and Britain at this time in our history?
I will come back to that Key of David shortly. But as you said there, you have all of these powers rising around the world. And meanwhile, the U.S. is struggling with money. Now, the U.S. budget may increase under Mr. Trump. We'll have to see. But a lot of the problems here, they go so much deeper than just money, than just funding problems. But you see all of these powers rising while the U.S. and while Britain are having some serious problems. And here, the Navy, that's really the front line of America's defense. So if that's having problems, it's very concerning. Now, I have another article that will be coming up soon on thetrumpet.com. It will be up there, I think, just in about an hour after we finish the show today. And it's called Defense Expert: It's Now Too Late to Stop China's Military Dominance of the South China Sea. And just to quote a bit from this article, it says China's illegal military buildup in the South China Sea is almost, quote, fully developed, and it is now too late to stop it. That is the assessment of Sir Angus Houston, the former head of the Australian Defence Force, in a speech last week to the National Security College Conference in Canberra, Australia. So it's almost it's getting close to being too late to intervene with China in the South China Sea. And he had a study of some of the latest satellite imagery in the region and the islands that have built there. And he said that, well, China's foothold is now basically permanent. He said all of this development, this is quoting Sir Angus, all of this development will enable China to dominate the South China Sea and extend its permanent military presence further south in proximity to Indonesia, Malaysia and Singapore. And Jeremiah Jacques in this article writes that dominance of the South China Sea is of global significance because some $5.3 trillion in commerce passes through it each year. That amounts to about one-third of the world's total trade. And Houston said, well, he said, in my view, it's too late to stop the China program in the South China Sea. So that's it. China has such a hold on this area, it's going to be impossible to dislodge. And in that Key of David that we listened to that brief clip from earlier about the shrinking of the U.S. military, well, he had some comments on this subject as well, and we'll play just a brief another clip from that now.
If you look, for example, at China today, there's a lot of tension now between China and the U.S., and China is going out and making a series of man-made islands 800 miles from their shore in the South China Sea. And of course, that land belongs to others as well as to them. They're out in international waters, but they are just building military bases there. And one-third of the world's commerce flows right through that area, that South China Sea. One-third of the world's commerce, and the U.S. has dominated that area since World War II. And now China's challenging them openly before the world, saying, we're going to dominate this area from now on. And nobody's stopping them. Nobody's even really talking about it that much, as if, well, it didn't really exist. But look, that isn't their territory. They're pushing their neighbors around and taking parts of their territory. And where is this going to lead? They have all this power. Now they've decided they're going to shift from defense to offense. Before, they've been concerned about controlling their billion people to make sure they keep their government intact. Now they've got that under control, well under control, and they're going to go on the offense. And let me tell you, this should frighten the world with all those people. And Revelation talks about an army of 200 million soldiers. And you know where a big part of those soldiers are coming from.
So that's I mean, that's a Key of David program from 2015, from a couple of years ago. So Mr. Fellow has been watching this right from the start. So we see China rising, and as he said there, going from the defense to offense. Just another article I'll mention quickly that I saw that talks about some of this from War on the Rocks, titled, Has China Been Practicing Preemptive Military Strikes Against U.S. Bases? And it talks about that. It talks about some of the threats that people are talking about from China. And it writes, in reality, the greatest military threat to U.S. vital interests in Asia may be one that has received somewhat less attention, the growing capability of China's missile forces to strike U.S. bases. This is a time of increasing tension, with China's news organizations openly threatening war. U.S. leaders and policymakers should understand that a preemptive Chinese missile strike against the forward bases that underpin U.S. military power in the Western Pacific is a very real possibility, particularly if China believes its claimed core strategic interests are threatened in the course of a crisis. And this article writes that such a preemptive strike appears consistent with available information from China's military force doctrine, missile force doctrine, and the satellite imagery shown below points to what may be real-world efforts to practice its execution. So China seems to be getting ready so that they can strike U.S. bases if they feel like they have to. It quotes an expert writing that in all Chinese military writings on conventional missile campaigns stress the importance of surprise and suggest a preference for preemptive strikes. It talks about how the U.S. has been, or that you know, China's missile forces have been publishing publications about striking vulnerable carriers and warships while they're in port, and they quote Toshi Yoshihara of the U.S. Naval War College, and he writes that the real possibility that U.S. bases in the Western Pacific could once again be vulnerable has occasioned little publicity or debate, but they could be vulnerable to this growing Chinese power. This article also points out that the U.S. military and civilian leaders may have a blind spot regarding the capabilities of the PLA rocket force because the U.S. has nothing like this. America's long-range missiles are all nuclear missiles, whereas just this idea of using conventional forces on long-range missiles in order to destroy bases is not something the U.S. has really worked on. And then it goes on to give quite a lot of different satellite pictures of various different test sites showing things that look like that they've created mock-ups of U.S. bases, constructed mock-ups of American ships to practice targeting on. And this article isn't saying to expect a Chinese attack on U.S. forces in the Pacific next week, but it's just pointing to the growing assertiveness, the growing aggressiveness of China in that region. Something that I said, Mr. Flurry, we heard from him talking about in 2015. So we see China rising. We see all of these powers rising around the world as America steps back from the world. They all see that as an opportunity. And we're seeing so many articles now talking about how we're entering into new times, into uncharted territory. But all of this new territory, this new world order that some articles have been talking about that we've read on this program over the last few weeks, it matches exactly what the trumpet has been forecasting for years. The Bible gives us a chart of all of this uncharted so-called territory that we're now entering into in international relations. And so it is sad to see Britain, to see America with all of these major problems. But you know, it is exciting in some ways as we move into this new territory and we see how closely it matches the map that we have from the Bible. And we don't necessarily have all of the details of what's going to happen from the Bible. And as we move forward, we start to see more and more of these details of these prophecies now start to take shape and outlines of how things will play out. And in a lot of ways, that is exciting because of what the Bible tells us is coming next. We know there is a lot of bad news on the horizon. You can see that just from the news reports. It's sad to see a U.S. where half of the Navy's aeroplanes can't fly, with a U.K. with a navy shrank to impotence. But that map of what is coming from the Bible also shows us that we're drawing near to the good news that comes after the bad news. The Bible says that all of this is leading to the return of Jesus Christ, a truth that we have to keep in mind as we watch all of the bad news building in the world. Well, that's about it from me today. My boss, Brad McDonald, will be on tomorrow, so that's an exciting opportunity to hear him talk about world events. Brent Nachtigall is visiting us from Israel. He'll be taking the show on Friday. If you have any comments for the show, for me, for them, you can email us at td@kpcg.fm. And then tune in at the same time tomorrow here on KPCG on 101.3 on the FM dial.